believe Mr. Liss is about to join us. A necessary party, perhaps. Mr. Roth, good morning to you.
And please the court, Chief Justice Hebekin, members of the court, my name is Brad Roth, and I represent the appellant in this case, James Yaza, and that is how his name is pronounced, Yaza. A number of years ago, I went to a seminar where a former Chief Justice was talking about how to prepare for oral argument. I've never forgotten that seminar. What the former Chief Justice said at that point was that when you start preparing for your oral argument, you need to think about what is fair and just. You put the books aside for a minute and think about what is fair and just. Because ultimately, that's what we're doing here, is trying to come to a fair and just result. In this case, what happened to Mr. Yaza with regard to his request for a blood test was not fair and just. We have a statute that indicates that law enforcement has a right to determine what type of test a person has to do who is suspected of driving while under the influence of alcohol. And that statute goes on to provide that once the law enforcement determine what type of test is going to be done, then the person alleged to be a violator and then have a separate test and have his physician or someone else perform a separate test. And if that's refused in some manner, that the first test is not considered competent evidence in the trial and will not be allowed. In this case, that's essentially what happened. Mr. Yaza was prevented from having the second test, and it goes back to the issue of what's fair and just.
Where specifically in the record was your client prevented from having that test?
Well, Judge, the way he was prevented was, A, he clearly requested the test. Secondly, two officers who were involved indicated that he could use a phone while he was in jail. Thirdly, there was testimony in the record that no one had come down in the jail that night and provided a test for him.
Counsel, your client paid, I think the record reflected approximately 45 phone calls, and not one of them was to a physician or hospital. It was only the morning of the motion to suppress that he bothered to call. What effect does that have on the situation where he doesn't call the night that he actually needs the test, but waits until the motion is suppressed to call?
I don't think it has any effect. I mean, the first call, I believe, was to me, but the reason I don't believe it has any effect, because even if he had, well, first of all, he wasn't aware he wasn't going to be bonded that night. He wasn't aware that he would not be able to put a bond up. He'd never been in jail before. So that the calls were being made to attempt to have somebody bond him out. There was a woman with him that night, and we gave her his money. Then there was he tried to call his brother. He first became aware that he was not able to bond later, I think it was 8 o'clock that morning. But the reason it's not important in this case is because when he did call later, and again, it was the day of the motion to suppress, everyone in Lincoln, Nebraska indicated they would not come down to the jail. And that just makes sense. Who's going to come down to the jail?
When you say everyone, he called every single provider in Lincoln, Nebraska. The record reflects that?
Well, he called Brian West. He called St. Elizabeth. He called Parallels. He called LabCorp. He called the jail itself because he was told that they might provide the test. I mean, sure, he could have made some other calls, but he called five providers that potentially could come down. In addition to that, Officer Morrow indicated that he'd been an officer for approximately 17 years, made over 1,000 arrests, and during that time he was not aware of anyone ever coming down to the jail to give a test. And again, that's just logic. What hospital is going to come down to the jail at 2 in the morning to provide a test?
Counsel, I don't know what else. What's your suggestions that the officers would have met the standard you believe there should be? What do you think they should have done here?
I think the officer should have provided reasonable assistance.
Okay, go on. What that doesn't give much guidance to the officers. What is reasonable assistance?
I would suggest to you that the officers that night, when they said to him, you can use the phone, I would suggest they knew. They knew that there was no one that was going to come down. They knew in 17 years, as far as Officer Morrow, that no one was going to come down to the jail. But the reasonable assistance they could have provided is once they knew that he was going to be in jail for 3.5 days, and that's essentially how long he was going to be because it was early Saturday morning. Following Monday was President's Day. He was going to be in jail till Tuesday afternoon. Once they knew that there was no way he was going to be able to have that occur, they had to take him and provide, have a test provided to him. He could have called somebody to obtain the money to do that, but he had no way to get there. I think that there's
so you're saying, really, that when the police officer requested a blood test instead of a breath test or a urine test, that they made the defendant's rights illusory because there was no way defendant was going to get a blood test while he was still in custody?
There's no way. There's no way.
I mean, the police officer could have requested a urine test, and then you'd have the urine sample, and you could have two different people test it. And that doesn't require a time constraint because the urine's there.
I think there's been all kinds of issues with urine tests. I'm not aware of any agency that uses urine anymore.
Could the agency, if they drew the blood, could they have saved a sample of that for someone else to test?
They could have.
That would have given him a remedy then. He wouldn't have had to have left the jail at that time. He could have had some other lab test part of that blood.
If they had requested a blood test. With the recent decisions from the United States Supreme Court, they rarely request a blood test anymore because they need a warrant. But they didn't request a blood test. They requested a breath test. Okay. If they'd have requested a blood test, this case would have been different. But a breath test, as you know, is not saved. You can't test it again. And so, as he testified at the motion to suppress, Mr. Gaza testified, I didn't think the breath test was accurate. That's why I requested a blood test, but I was prevented from having it. Well,
is it assumed that the breath, blood, and urine tests are all relatively accurate measurements of content of blood alcohol?
Well, there's disagreement on that, Your Honor, but there's been a lot of disagreement on whether a urine test is accurate. And again, Mr. Yaz had heard that blood tests, he's not a scientist by any means, but he had read that the blood test was the most accurate. I can tell you from many trials that most experts tell you the blood test is the gold standard.
If the state decided that they were going to request a blood test, where would that blood have been drawn?
At the hospital. I'm not aware of them ever taking someone at corrections to get a blood test. They always take them to a hospital. They have a kit, and they perform a forensic test.
So they do that. That wasn't a novel procedure for this case.
They do it all the time. They don't do it all the time, but they do it on occasion.
So as part of their routine, it wouldn't have been out of sorts to have taken this guy to a hospital to get a blood test and then save that sample, had that tested, and then they come back and give the breath test or vice versa.
That's absolutely correct. And in the record,
statute talks about preventing, however. The statute doesn't say anything about you affirmatively have to find someone to do a blood test for a potential defendant, does it?
That's correct. But that's what they did, essentially. I mean, if he'd have been able to bond out, then having a phone or whatever would work. But when he's in jail for 3.5 days, I don't know how that's not preventing. If somebody would have potentially come down to jail, that wouldn't have been a prevention. Then they gave him a phone. But as the record indicates, no one comes down to the Lancaster County Jail. I suspect anywhere no one comes down to do a blood test because when you call someone, the message to the person is, well, this person's in jail. And even leaving that aside, no one comes down
anywhere to do a blood test. He did have an alternative that he could have said, well, you're going to make me take a breath test. I want an alternate test. I can't get a breath test, but I can give a urine sample here while I'm in custody and then have that tested.
Well, he could have. And again, I think that there's a real issue whether a urine sample is determined to be valid. But again, his testimony...
Well, a statute. Provides that it's valid.
Well, there's been cases that have questioned whether a urine sample is valid. But what
I beg your pardon, you're working on implementing 66-199.
Correct.
What have other states done in the face of similar statutes?
Well, in my brief, Georgia, Alabama, Oregon, there's a case out of the Supreme Court of Florida that says this kind of situation, when the person is unable, he or she is prevented from hitting another, you know, leaving jail, that reasonable assistance has to be provided. I know that's somewhat, you know, it's not a specific
statement. But some, do you have some facts to flush out reasonable assistance?
Well, not being able to get out of jail to go somewhere, or not.
But
not
that reasonable, providing reasonable assistance, not what they didn't do, but what they can do. What can they do?
They can take them to a hospital and get a test.
And are you aware of cases that say that that is in the nature of reasonable assistance?
Yes. I believe State v. Unruh, I'm pronouncing that right. It's in the brief.
That's a California case.
I believe that's Supreme Court of Florida, I believe.
Oh, big pardon.
Mr. Roth, sure. I know your time has expired, but isn't your argument in essence asking this court to judicially amend the section to change the word permitted to assisted, or permit to assist?
I'm not sure it's request. I'm requesting to amend the statute. If essentially a constructive prevention occurs, that the officers have to provide some assistance. Again, it goes back to what's fair and just. A person has no means to get an additional test. I think the officers need to provide reasonable assistance. I think that's just fair.
Can you provide any definition of the word permit, which includes an affirmative duty as opposed to the absence of negative?
Well, I just think, Your Honor, I just think in certain permit would be when the defendant is not able to, on his own, to get it in some manner. And the cases in Nebraska, Dake and some other cases, they bond out. This case is different from Dake and Hamilton and some of the other cases. They're able to bond out, or they did bond out. This case, this gentleman had no means for 3.5 days to get out of jail. That's what I'm requesting.
One more question. What was your client's test level according to the breath test taken?
Yes.
What was the number?
0.191, I believe.
It wasn't even close.
It was not.
Does that make a difference?
Well, it makes a difference in the sense that Mr. Gaza testified he had 2 large beers. Doesn't seem possible. That's what he said. His testimony was, I can't believe my test came up that high, and that's why I wanted an additional test. Again, he was trying to find some exculpatory evidence. He didn't know what that term meant, but he was saying, it can't be right. I want a blood test. That's right out of the bat, when he heard what it was, he said, I want a blood test. I don't think that's correct. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bliss, good morning to you.
With. I'll start where Justice Castle left off. The statute in question provides that if the person tested shall be permitted to have a physician of their choice evaluate their condition and only their tests they deem necessary. Our statute as well as our case law interpreting the statute may clear that it will require that the person be permitted to have such testing done. This obviously can't hinder or impede a person's ability to get that testing done under the duty to assist or facilitate it,
nor
are they required to advise them.
Right. If he can't bond out and he can't go anywhere to get the blood test, you're saying that this is discretionary with the police as to whether or not they want to take him to the hospital or not. They don't have to do that.
There's no duty imposed on them to.
But by having him incarcerated, he has no ability to get an alternative test.
Well, his ability would be limited to arranging somebody to come to facility and do the testing.
Wouldn't that discriminate against people of lesser means? In other words, a person who had a working or a good relationship with their doctor and had lots of money could convince their doctor to come down and take that test and be charged for it by their doctor, as opposed to somebody like this who couldn't, probably doesn't even have a doctor.
I don't think
the officer didn't have a doctor because he didn't call one, did he?
I'm sorry?
He obviously didn't have a doctor, did he, because he didn't call one.
Well, he testified that he did, but his doctor's not included, which poses another problem. I guess my response to the appellant's assertion about incarceration being an unfair obstacle to getting independent testing is threefold. Number one, statute does not impose a duty to assist or facilitate it. It says it shall be permitted. That's all that it says. There's no language requiring something more in the context of incarceration. Number two, our appellate courts have construed this to say there is no duty to facilitate it. It only has to be permitted. The legislature is aware of those opinions. They haven't responded and inserted anything additional into the statute. We submit they've acquiesced. And number three, from a practical standpoint, I don't see how police could facilitate or accommodate these requests. They don't have the time or the resources to be chauffeuring people around town to do this. And I would also point out that the statute affords somebody a right to have a physician of their choice do this testing. I mean, it's not good enough to just take them to the hospital. If a person says, I want this physician, we're going to have to accommodate that. And what do you do with an individual such as Mr. Yasa, who's not from Lincoln, that might say, my primary physician is in North Platte? If we're going to strictly honor that statute,
but the statute does, the statute also says have the test performed, so it wouldn't necessarily be limited to the physician doing the blood work.
Well, it says
isn't that how it reads?
True.
So a physician could designate a phlebotomist to, or something. Couldn't they? Under the statute?
That arguably could take place, but nonetheless, the individual in question is going to have the option to use a physician of their choice, and I would say, arguably, a facility of their choice as well would be the logical extension of that. I'm not quite sure how we accommodate that.
So you're saying that in the course of things, the police, 99.9% of the time, will simply require a blood test because the other two tests would require them to take the defendant to some place to collect the blood or the urine.
Well, I don't know that I would say that.
They have that choice, and they always make that choice to do a breath test because basically the defendant, if he's in jail, can't get a separate test.
To my knowledge, that's not the rationale for doing breath tests. I think, especially after Birchfield, the primary reason for doing breath tests is you don't have to do the warrant. Blood tests are far more burdensome now, and so a breath test is just more feasible and practical.
Okay.
I don't think that that's their motive.
So you've given a valid reason for why they request the breath test instead of a urine test?
Sure, a chemical test is just far more practical.
What, if anything, is the significance of the officer saying they haven't seen a physician come and do a blood work at the jail?
Well, I mean, as I stated in brief, I don't know that I would go as far as to agree that that means it's not possible.
There's no app for that.
Right. I mean, it may be the case that somebody will not come. I suspect that somebody would, at least some private physician would come do it. I don't know that to be the case. I don't know that it's not the case. I'm not sure one way or the other.
Okay.
But
our record really doesn't speak to that, does it?
No, it doesn't. And there was testimony that the officers were aware of no obstacle that would be imposed in the event that somebody came to do such testing. Their knowledge, it would be allowed. And there was no attempt, obviously, to arrange the testing facility. That obstacle never arose, assuming there would have been. Just briefly, Justice Miller, when you asked about other states, I did not have time to do an individual survey of all the other states. I ran a few searches and I was getting thousands of results. I didn't have a chance to wade through all of them, but I did go look at an ALR on the matter. And from what I've seen there, assuming it's all accurate, the vast majority of states, literally the vast majority of states, are saying what we've said, that there is no duty to assist or facilitate these tests. There are a few, the appellant cited three in their brief, and there are a few more out there that do say, you know, reasonable assistance could be provided or should be provided depending on the circumstances. It's basically a circumstantial analysis. And then there's even a third smaller camp of states that are saying, well, you may have a duty to do reasonable assistance, but only if the defendant has requested and arranged that testing and it can otherwise be accomplished. But again, the vast majority have said there is no duty other than to permit it if the defendant has arranged for it. Further questions on that issue, I'll just briefly move on to the Title 177 15-minute observation period issue. We submit this requirement was complied with as well. The record reflects that Officer Morrow observed Mr. Yasa for the full 15-minute period and instructed him on how to do the test, rather than the physician advisement form while Officer Sears filled out the checklist technique form and actually reported the result. In our view, this complies with Title 177. Special officers jointly handled this case. They both have Class B permits, and they're both trained in administering chemical breath tests. The fact that Officer Sears did not conduct the 15-minute observation period is immaterial in our view. Either Title 177 nor this checklist technique requires that. We see no basis for that conclusion.
Do you think it's important that they both had Class B permits?
Well, I think it's important in the sense that they are both trained and aware of what observations to make.
That's because they have a Class B permit.
Right, right.
Sometimes if you have a jailer just watching for the 15 minutes, are they trained to know what to look for?
Well, I suspect they may not be, and that could pose a potential problem, especially if the officer actually leaves them with the jailer, leaves the room entirely and is no longer there, and that person doesn't know what to watch for. Yeah, that could be a problem. Could it be shored up with adequate communication? Maybe, but yeah, that could potentially be a problem.
I'm curious, what are they looking for in this 15-minute period?
Belching, burping, regurgitation, anything that might produce more alcohol into the person's mouth and affect the blood alcohol content reading.
Or putting something in your mouth.
Well, sure, right.
Chewing gum or...
anything that could contaminate the breath test, right. The only other point I'd make on the 15 minutes observation period is I didn't note this case in my brief. I wasn't aware of it. I recently encountered it. Safety Shepherd, in the context of PBTs, this court held that Title 177's 15-minute observation period does not require an officer to fixedly stare at a suspect during the test. A 15-minute observation period requires only that they be in a position to detect occurrences or events that might contaminate the breath test. We would submit the same rationale that's true in the context of the chemical breath test. The checklist technique forms for chemical breath tests are virtually identical to those PBTs regarding the 15-minute observation period. So we would submit the same rationale that's true here. In any event, if this court were to find this didn't strictly comply with Title 177, we submit that this was purely an error of efficiency of technique. Further questions, I'll submit the validity of the stop. That's the affirmative judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. On we go to hints.